What is it about race in this country? Why can't we all get along? Why do people in power oppress people who are not? And how is it that people learn to hate? Martin Luther King Jr. was shot in Memphis 45 years ago. He was simply too much of a threat to too many people. I was just 10 years old, but remember it vividly. As soon as I heard about it, I thought, well, our cities are going to be on fire. I've always wondered what the spark is that turns a cause into a movement, and then a movement into, hopefully, eventually, the status quo. Who are the brave people who have the guts to stand up to those who would knock them down? One of those is Sheila Michaels. Ms. Michaels lived in St. Louis, Missouri, not a place of racial integration or enlightenment, when she was moved to head south, where she became a veteran of the civil rights movement, and who you can learn more about by visiting a fascinating website featuring veterans of the civil rights movement. The website is crmvet.org, and it is indeed fascinating. Sheila Michaels is also the woman who conceived the term Ms. for women so that their marital status wasn't what defined them. Ms. Michaels, welcome. Ms. Michaels. I'm Alan Jennings, and I'm your host of Lehigh Valley Discourse. This is WDIY, community-supported public radio, 88.1 FM.
Oh.
And there's Ms. Michaels. Good evening, Ms. Michaels.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Hardly.
Okay.
Something just popped and, okay, is it, there's nothing on your line that could have popped, right?
I hope not.
Hold on.
Are you okay? Can you hear me?
Well, I didn't, it doesn't seem to be anything here.
Okay. Were you able to hear my introduction of you?
Yes, and then that was when it started popping.
Okay. Let me also introduce Kevin Easterling. Kevin is the executive director of the Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King Memorial Project.
Right.
Kevin organized the Vilania Park Festivals. He worked for a variety of organizations doing good, and in my opinion, is one of the most activist of African Americans in the Lehigh Valley. I've known Kevin for more than 20 years. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Alan.
Well, you know, you approached me with the issue, and I said, you know, this is a great time. This is, the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, there's so many different things to recognize. But let's start with Ms. Michaels with the question of why you left Missouri to pursue a justice agenda for black Americans in 1961.
Hold on a second. This dog thinks his name is shut up. But I'm going to try and go into another room. This is fascinating radio, I know.
Well, the dog lovers just
okay.
Signed on.
Okay. I only have one door that I can shut in this apartment.
Ms. Michaels is in New York City.
Hello, can you hear me?
Are you here?
Yes. Okay, well, it's still kind of dim.
What what moved you to leave Missouri to pursue a justice
agenda?
Okay, well,
I actually left Missouri in order to come to New York when I was 20. So I didn't go south and, I joined the civil rights movement in 61. And I wanted to, you know, I had a bad conscience about segregation. It was wrong. And whether I had intended it or not, I was a participant. So anyway, I felt it was terribly, terribly wrong, and there was a little, was it Ruby Bridges? Yeah, there was that sort of made me want to go, and then the bus was burned, and I felt, well, I had to do something.
Where,
so that was when I joined intending to go on the Freedom Rides. But at the time that I went to the national office, and I was supposed to have gone to the local, and you had to be a member for a participating member for a certain number of months. And by the time I was sort of eligible to go, they were asking people not to go anymore because it was too expensive for CORE to be getting people out of jail and representing them. Mississippi wanted to break them financially, and they were doing everything that they could to drain, you know, the coffers of CORE.
When you went, did you go with others, or did you just do this on your own without, you know, kind of off to a new world?
No, I went down. I was active in New York CORE, and then the following year, I went to a nonviolent workshop in Houston, and I was supposed to have a job in Jackson, Mississippi, and I went to it, and the guy had given my job to somebody else. And I wound up working for SNCC and CORE, had a kind of joint office, Jackson Freedom Movement, and I wound up working there.
When you, first of all, I'm surprised as I've been setting up the show how few people really understand what happened with the Freedom Rides. And
sure.
There's a remarkable documentary on the web that you can watch called Freedom Rides, and it is one of those kind of things that just absolutely is spellbinding.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I've done some things that I've been kind of proud of in my time, but I can't imagine getting on one of those buses and going into the belly of the beast.
It's scary.
Were you with CORE while the Freedom Rides were taking place?
I joined as the Freedom Rides started, about the time of the burning of the first bus. Well, there was only one bus burning, but when the first bus was burned. And
it was kind of firebombed, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Weren't you scared to death?
Well, I wasn't on that bus.
Yeah, but I mean, being part of CORE in that climate had to be absolutely scary.
Well, it was lethal, but it was lethal for just people who lived. You know, even New York was not certainly no haven. I mean, if you walk down the street in a group of mixed group of black and white people, people were staring at you, and some of them with real hatred, you know. This was just being black made people jumpy.
There were stops where the police told, you know, a mob of some 200 white armed men, thugs, that they would give them 15 minutes to do whatever they wanted to the bus riders, and gosh, I can't imagine.
That was when John Lewis got a concussion, right?
Well, no, John Lewis was the Selma to Montgomery.
No, John Lewis was John Lewis.
Oh, on the bus. Oh, that's right, on the Freedom Rides too.
From Cairo on,
right.
From Cairo, Illinois, swimming pool integration, which I think was in 1959 or. Maybe 1958. I don't know.
I'm one of those people that's enamored with, celebrity and people with historic relevance, and I'm proud to have met John Lewis. Proud to have been in meetings with Jesse Jackson. Our agency was the recipient of an award that was handed to me by Jesse Jackson. But your work at CORE and SNCC put you in contact with James Farmer.
Yes.
Ralph Abernathy.
Yeah.
Stokely Carmichael?
Yeah.
Julianne Bond?
Yep.
It's truly amazing. And your close brush with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Well, yeah. He built a house right next to where I was living, and I went back to Mississippi just before they moved in, so our paths did not cross except through my roommate, Mary, who was worked with him a lot.
Mary
was CORE's first female field secretary in the South. So And he used to call her Red because he enjoyed watching her get angry.
Did you appreciate at the time that you were in the presence of people who would become such legendary figures?
Yep.
Is that because they were already there, or because you could sense them? I mean, did they have certain leadership qualities, charisma?
Well, we were the only ones doing it, you know. So it was one of the smartest groups of people I've ever been in. I ran with a smart crowd in high school, but clever too. I mean, people who sort of knew their way around things. Some of them, you know, farm kids and who knew how to do things and figure things out. And I had to trust their instincts instead of my own.
Was your safety ever compromised?
Well, yeah. You mean like?
I mean, were you ever in a situation
a closed gas station in the middle of the night when the bus drops you off and the Klan is circling around?
Oh,
and
God.
You're trying to use the telephone and there's nobody there to pick you up. You mean like that?
Yeah, that would be a good start. Each of the gentlemen that we were just talking about, of course, are legendary. But one could argue, really, that the real heroes are the regular folks. I mean, it would seem to me that a person who has some status is going to be, you know, especially when it's cowards that are doing such cowardly things and usually only doing it in mobs or in the cover of darkness or with weapons that could enable them to kind of hide away. But the people who were on those buses, the regular folks that just decided to do what they did, really, you could argue, were the real heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you then decided to begin an oral history of those individuals. Can you talk about that?
My roommate, Mary, and I had not been talking for 12 years, and I had been thinking about her one night and just crying. I'd seen a picture that I had identified as her in Danny Lyon's book. One of Danny Lyon's books. And I don't know why I started crying. I just didn't know. And the next day, she called and said, "Sheila, I can't stop thinking about you. I just can't. I woke up in the middle of the night, and I just can't stop thinking about you." So it was, my mojo was working, you know. And we talked for about 45 minutes, and at the end she said, "Oh, by the way, I have fourth stage ovarian cancer." Well, you know. So I immediately went to see her, and I thought, well, wait a second. This woman was really famous in her day. I mean, she was the it girl. She was incredibly brave and la pasionara of our time. And nobody knew her name, except for Hamilton v. Alabama. So except for one case where she, that went to the Supreme Court, where the court did not address her, they were addressing her as Mary, and she said, "My name is Miss Hamilton." It's called the Miss Mary case. And she wouldn't answer to Mary. And the judge found her in contempt of court. And the thing is that he called her into his private office with the NAACP counsel who was representing her. And he said to the counsel, "Well, if that little filly were in my kitchen, I know what I'd do with her." And she was in contempt of court, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyway, she was famous among us. And I thought, well, her story's lost. She's never written it. You know, even though she was taught English for years, she had never written anything down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to get most of the oral history libraries in this country to, and everybody said, oh, no, their civil rights stuff was closed. And finally, the second time I got in touch with Columbia University, they said, well, we're not doing it, but if you do it, you know, we'll store it for you. And then when I went in to learn what I was supposed to learn in 45 minutes, they said, you know everybody in CORE, and CORE hasn't been, there are no oral histories of CORE. Mm. And I thought that couldn't be, and they said, he said, oh, everybody did SNCC, you know. And then when I started running into SNCC people, well, when I called people who had to have been interviewed in CORE, and I said, you know, have you had an oral history? And they said, no, you do it. Good, good idea. So Mary was the start of my oral history, and it was at the time nobody was recognizing that women had done most of the work and men had taken most of the credit in the movement. And there really wasn't, I mean, all of the showboats had gotten fame, and the people who did the actual everyday work, years of their lives poured into the movement, thank you. You know, not even thank you, because we were barred from the movement. But so I decided to start doing that. And then when I started talking to SNCC people, they said, well, people kept saying, well, nobody's interviewed me, you know, and no, nobody's been around since 1967. So that was how my oral history project got started.
I was curious, Ms. Michaels, had you known Bruce Hartford then from the Civil Rights Movement Vets website? Because they have an excellent listing of the oral histories of...
You know how it started? It was PTSD, and somebody who was really important in the Mississippi movement, really, really important, had gotten a kind of nervous breakdown. And a group of people in San Francisco, where he had moved, got together and said, you know, we've got to support him. You know, we can't let anything happen to him. And so they got together and they started having meetings and figuring out what they could do for him, what they could do to support him. And eventually it grew into the CRMV.org, CRMVet.org site. Bruce started collecting stuff. And since he was, he did security for the...
He's a technical writer.
Yeah, he's a technical writer, but he was also a writer on security for mechanical things. Websites and everything. And so he's been doing this pretty much full-time since he retired.
You're listening to WDIY. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest tonight is Ms. Sheila mm-hmm. Michaels, a veteran of the Civil Rights Movement. I also have with me Kevin Easterling, the executive director of the Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King Memorial Project. We're going to take a short break, and we hope you stay with us. Please stick around.
But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
It's 41 degrees in the Lehigh Valley. The time is 6:21. Lehigh Valley Discourse continues.
April 4, shut rings out in Memphis.
April 4th, 1968 had to be a turning point. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. This is, I'm Alan Jennings. I'm your host. During my real life, I am the executive director of the Community Action Committee of the Lehigh Valley, but once or twice, sometimes three times a month, the WDIY gives me this forum to talk about public affairs issues. And, you know, one of the great justice movements of our time has been the civil rights movement. And on the show with me tonight is Kevin Easterling, the executive director of the Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King Memorial Project, and also the honor of having Sheila Michaels, who is in New York and with us on the phone. Ms. Michaels went south in 1961 to join the movement and worked for both the Congress on Racial Equality and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, where she met the great Americans who had so much to do with the civil rights movement, but as also the regular folks whose courage was just really, truly unbelievable. Ms. Michaels, how would you see April 4th, 1968 in terms of the movement? Was it indeed a turning point?
Was that when Dr. King was killed?
Right.
You were playing that speech, and I always cry when I hear it.
I
think that he knew. I can't see any other reason for him to have riffed like that.
It was just hours later that he was shot.
Yeah. I think that something told him that, I mean, so many of us were always living on pins and needles, whatever, because there was always some gun just around the corner. But I think what he was saying was you know, his time was near, and he knew peace now. And I always weep.
Yeah. One of the things that has amazed me, and I want to bring another ethnic constituency into this discussion, is American Jews. During the
That's me. I'm an American Jew.
During the 20s and 30s, the left intelligentsia was almost all Jewish, and in the 60s, a good amount of the whites who joined the movement were Jewish. What was it about the civil rights movement that attracted Jewish Americans?
Well, we had, you know, there were quotas against us in schools. There were professions that were barred to us. There were, you couldn't, even if you weren't barred, you could never rise very far. And, you know, which is the reason that almost every city has a Jewish hospital, because Jewish doctors were not allowed. You could get a medical degree if you were better than anybody else, you know, just like being Chinese now. You know, you can get into a good school but there's still a quota. There is still it was always the feeling that we were outsiders, and black people were outsiders, and we were not discriminated against in quite the same way, but it was still like, you know, people, you didn't marry a Jew, you know.
Yeah. The one of the things that seemed to change from my perspective is the militancy of black Americans at the time. The Black Panther Party became more prominent. And one of the things that developed around that time seemed to have been the rift between Jews and blacks, the historic relationship that was, you know, two constituencies that were oppressed started finding themselves going in different directions. What do you think? What do you think caused that?
As I said, there were a lot of agents provocateurs who were doing whatever they could to pit people against each other, you know, writing letters to wives saying your husband is having an affair when the poor man wasn't, or whatever, or trying to force people to do more radical things than was wise. you know, the great firebrands in any organization were sometimes police agents. But I think that the moment, well, the first place, whites were thrown out of the movement in pretty much in 1964. Not pretty much. We were told that, you know, we shouldn't be working in the South and we shouldn't be working with black people anymore. And then in a few people stayed in Mississippi for one reason or another, but it was, people were kind of frozen out. A lot of people who were very important, Charles Sherrod, who was one of the founders of SNCC, left at that time. I don't know about Julian. He was kind of, I don't think he stayed past like 60. I ran into him in 66 or 67 in the office. So he was still around for a little while, but most people, when whites were barred from the movement, decided that it was no longer an interracial movement and it was time to leave. And that happened in CORE as well.
And when did you leave?
I went home. I'm not home. I mean, I went to New York in 1964 after the Democratic National Convention. I was so near, and I went and stayed with some friends, and I sort of stayed for more than a month. And then a friend of mine came north and said, don't go back. It's nothing there anymore. You know, it's nothing there barring white people. And that happened at Waveland. And Susan Brown Miller wrote about it in Our Time. She had left her job and apartment and everything else to go south and then was told that the job wasn't there for her anymore. And so then a couple of years later, the SNCC declared itself to be against the State of Israel, for Palestinians and against the State of Israel. And I don't know how anybody sane could have done that, because the mainstay of the movement was the unions. And the unions, many, many union leaders, honest union leaders, were Jewish. And I am, you know, I am pro-Palestinian, if you will, but also for the State of Israel. Anybody who lived during the Second World War had to have been. And I was a baby, but I still knew that if the Nazis won, that I was going to be killed. It was like the last straw. And after that, it was like, well, you know, if the door is closed to me, if I'm not welcome, you know, let me. And they said, you know, go organize whites for civil rights. And some people did. Some people went to Newark and tried to organize. Mostly it was like, that's a very strange idea. So that's sort of, it left space for the women's movement to start. And even though, you know, a lot of the women in the early women's movement were married to black men, it was still there was this point of, wait a second, you know, we're very oppressed. You know, we just got the vote like 20 years ago. Come on, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, Ms. Michaels, I had a question. On the Civil Rights Movement's website, there's actually it's called The Basis of Black Power, and it talks about when SNCC actually elected Stokely Carmichael as the president. And it talked about the shift to the Black Power movement, but it was determined that it was really more of a type of self-determination. The charge was made that we are racist, but whites who are sensitive to our problem will realize that we must determine our own destiny. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, history is left to be interpreted, but there was a sense that blacks at the time were trying to feel empowered, but the message got mixed up. Did you kind of see that? Because there was a lot of different fractions, as you said.
Well, everybody had sympathy for it, but still, Stokely's election was a little questionable. I loved Stokely, so that's not a question of whether I feel that he should have been chair or not. And I love John. But apparently, I didn't know until I read John's book that he had been elected chair of SNCC again, and Jim Foreman had decided that he wasn't, that when he was leaving, he wanted John to be leaving, too. He didn't want John staying on as chairman. And so after everybody went to bed, they reconvened the meeting and elected Stokely. And I had no idea, because when I was up here in New York, Ruby Doris Robinson was dying, Ruby Doris Smith was dying, and I didn't know it. I mean, John said, you should go and see her. And I said, you know, we hate each other. And he said, no, it's the Christian thing to do. And I said, well, you know, I'm not a Christian. But I hadn't realized, because he never went to see her. I was with Ruby Doris while she was dying. Her other so-called friends were not, except for Jim Foreman. And, you know, it was like, where are her friends? But John never showed up. And I didn't realize that he, Christian or not, could not bring himself to do it. Could not, because she had engineered the rigged election that put Stokely in.
Ms. Michaels, I want to thank you for your heroic work on behalf of racial justice in America, and for being available to us, and for the work you've done to preserve history. And so thank you so much for joining us on the show. I wish you the very best, and I want to just give you an opportunity. If you have anything final you want to say before we move on, I'll give you that opportunity.
Well, it's time for a new movement. It's time for an economic movement, and that may be a little harder, but the conditions are, you know, optimal.
Well, that's what Dr. Truth. King pushed for towards
40 years
the movement, mm-hmm. The poor people's movement in economic equity, and so
that was more of a threat than
Nash,
us were
when she didn't
accept.
Want to work on, you know, on sit-ins, was saying, you know, what are we going to get, a hamburger? You know, that wasn't you know, the right to have a hamburger when you can't afford it.
Right.
You know?
Ms. Michaels, thank you so much for your good work, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Yes, thanks. Bye-bye.
You're listening to WDIY, listener-supported community public radio. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. It is time for, it's the time of the year, and we ought to be doing this every day throughout the year, but recognizing what's right and what's wrong in America, and how we try to fix what's wrong and make it right. I want to now move to, well, first thing I need to do is to thank Otto Bost. Otto has a much better radio voice than I do. I'm always jealous to hear him on the radio he comes on before I do, and he go from this great radio voice to my lousy voice. So Otto, thanks for being here and for helping us out. Kevin Easterling, you know, when I list the African Americans in the Lehigh Valley who are really active and have been active for years and never gave up and never seem to possibly ever give up, you're right near the top.
Well, thank you. So
thanks for being on the show. What is it about you? I mean, how did you become so engaged? Why are you so much more engaged than so many others who are, you know, really sitting on the sidelines?
You know, that's an interesting question. First, I'd like to think that you know, I was blessed with a mother who really allowed me to have vision. I grew up here in the Lehigh Valley. I actually grew up in the old South Terrace projects, and my mother worked her way through business school and got hired to Mack Trucks. And it kind of gave me the envision that, you know, we have certain things that allow us to be engaged, and so you should be. And so I was kind of blessed with an opportunity and a mother who gave me that vision to see it. I think there were also some other major situations that happened in my life that really kept me engaged. I actually, when we moved to Allentown, a lot of people don't know, but in the mid to late 70s, city of Allentown still had busing. And so at that time, where I lived in Allentown, on the downtown Allentown, South 5th Street, Villania Park area, all the African-American and Latino kids, it would take us an hour and a half to get to Little Lehigh Parkway on the south side. And we were the first group of African-American and Latino kids who actually attended Lehigh Parkway. And so there was that vision and certain things that happened that made me say, you know, life needs to be engaging. And so some of that and some of my travels and just engagement of people who I've been able to be involved with.
You are involved in the Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King Memorial. It's a spectacular, I mean, it's a truly beautiful monument along Martin Luther King Drive in Allentown, right near the Parquette's building. We're going to have to take a break in about a minute or so. That was Harry Roberts' project, and how did that happen?
Yes, Harry Roberts was the founder. Harry was actually on our board when we used to do the Black Heritage Festival in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in the early 90s, early 2000s. And he had always had this dream that he wanted to build a monument to Dr. King. And he persevered, and connected up with Sam Bennett and a couple other people in the community, and was able to secure funding in 2008 to start that project. But Harry was the life and the dream of it, and he had just come to me to ask me to be a part of it and to make sure that we can build that dream. Unfortunately, Harry passed March 26th of 2008, right when we had received a major portion of the funding to
and
build
never
it
saw his live stream come to
never
to reality.
Never got to see it. No, he didn't. But
we're going to take another break. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, listener-supported community public radio. Martin Luther King's birthday, our national celebration, is just around the corner. My guest tonight, Kevin Easterling. We just heard from Sheila Michaels, a veteran of the Civil Rights Movement. Stick around.
For the tongues, with no place to bring their thoughts, all down in taken for granted situations, tolling for the deaf and blind, tolling for the mute, for the mistreated mateless mother, the mistitled prostitute, for the misdemeanor outlaw, chained and cheated by pursuit. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Kirkridge Retreat and Study Center, providing a place for rest and renewal to pilgrims along life's journey since 1942. Located on the Kittatinny Ridge near the Delaware Water Gap, upcoming retreats in February: Easter in the Journey of the Universe with Michael Morwood, Becoming Your Authentic Self in Leadership with Jean Richardson, Hildegard of Bingen, Cosmic Christ Mysticism and the Renewal of Christianity with Matthew Fox. More information, kirkridge.org.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. Is your car so environmentally incorrect that it creates its own ecosystem?
Donate it through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
This station gets the proceeds and you get a tax break.
To find out more, call 866-789-8627.
Car Talk airs Friday night at 6 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. For more information, visit our website at WDIY.org.
Well, the only person talking about love, man, brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to my nation.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse on listener-supported community public radio. This is WDIY. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. In my real life, I work for the Community Action Committee of Lehigh Valley, an organization that was established around 1965. And really grew out of the civil rights movement itself. The whole concept of community action was part of the war on poverty. And if it weren't for the civil rights movement, there wouldn't have been the justice movement that followed and the federal government's increasingly active role in trying to intervene in the marketplace to ensure that everybody has access to economic opportunity. My guest is Kevin Easterling. Kevin's a longtime friend and one of the true activists in the African American community, and is now carrying on the legacy of Harry Roberts, the late Harry Roberts, who made the Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King Memorial Project possible. Kevin, what's the agenda? First of all, I know that the memorial's got some real special aspects of it that make it pretty unique.
Yeah, we were fortunate in that the actual sculptorist, gentleman who sculpted the actual statue, gentleman by the name of Ed Dwight. Ed Dwight has a very interesting story. Ed Dwight was actually the first African American who was in the Nassau program. Back then, I guess Kennedy, as Ed tells the story, Kennedy and Harry Belafonte called him and said, "How would you like to be the most important Negro in the country?" Because at that time, being a astronaut was a pretty big shadoo.
Heck yeah.
And so I forget the director of the Urban League at the time, Harry Belafonte. They said, "Look, we need a Negro in Nassau." And Ed Dwight, he's probably one of the most smartest individuals I've ever met. But he was a jet pilot in the Air Force. Took the test, and I guess there were about 10 or 15 applicants, and he was the one that passed. And he was a part of Nassau and was the first to graduate from the Nassau. So he's considered the first black astronaut. Later got into sculpturing after him and Lyndon B. Johnson, I guess, got into a little riff, and he ended up leaving Nassau and decided he wanted to become a sculpturist. And now he's one of the most prolific African-American, well, I should say sculptors, period, in the country. He was actually runner-up to the National Memorial in Washington, D.C., and we had actually scouted him out when we were putting out proposals to actually do the project, and he came on board and did an excellent job.
And you're doing what you can to make sure that the legacy of Harry Roberts and Martin Luther King Jr. Lives on in the form of the sculpture. What kinds of things have you got planned?
Exactly. Well, one of the first things we're doing, the project was actually unveiled in January of 2011. And so we are actually winding down our closeout of what we call phase one. And phase one really just dealt with us actually building, completing, putting out the final cost for the actual project. And then phase two, and that's kind of how we connected with the civil rights movement vets, because once I connected with them and saw the a lot of people don't realize how enormous the civil rights movement was. And like Sheila said, a lot of the people who were, you know, working in the streets and actually doing the actual nonviolent passive resistance, and those are the people who really made the movement. And so one of our goals is really to just push civil rights and what the civil rights vets call the freedom movement, history education locally in our schools, to different organizations. And so when you and I spoke about this, I said, "Hey, I got just the group I want to connect us with." That's how we actually came up with Sheila Michael. She's a part of the civil rights movement vets. So one of our things is just to stay on some of the main issues that Dr. King and the civil rights movement pushed. It should be also known that the memorial is the only memorial in the world that actually has Dr. King and Coretta. There's a lot of memorials with just Dr. King, but a lot of people don't give the credit, or even the civil rights movement was criticized for not really engaging women, especially at the higher leadership levels, as Sheila Michael, Ms. Sheila Michaels alluded to. And so we're here to just really try to push the teachings of civil rights. You know, we just had a situation in some of our school districts where they're actually really trying to remove social studies and different history programs in the schools. And so it's our goal, you know, once we close out the construction, to really be that civil rights advocacy group here in the Lehigh Valley.
You know, I as I said earlier, I just am so enamored with and fascinated by the courage that so many people had in moving the agenda. And I'm proud of having met John Lewis and gotten his autograph on his book, and I've got Spike Lee's autograph on one of those Malcolm X hats, which I'm awful proud of, and it's hidden so nobody can get to it. And you know, the fact that I've been with Jesse Jackson a few times and so on. But injustice really inflames me. I mean, to the point where sometimes I have a hard time kind of keeping my cool. Billy Joel's Angry Young Man is almost a theme song for me. Of course, I'm not young anymore, but I'm a white guy. I've never really been a victim unless, you know, I put myself in a category of part of humanity. And when anybody is oppressed or mistreated, we all are oppressed and mistreated. How do you deal with the emotions and of oppression? Why is it that somebody would look at you, see you as looking different than them, and hate you for that, or mistreat you for that, or discriminate against you you for that? And how do you control your emotions in the face of that kind of climate?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think for me personally, being an African American here, particularly in the Lehigh Valley, for most of my life, is something that you kind of, you don't accept it, but you know it when you see it. And a lot of times, I think we built up inside protection systems, and you stay engaged. I think years ago, people used to say, you know, racism is learned and so forth and all that stuff. And so I'd go even further. You know, there's certain parts of, you know, racism that is institutionalized. And so once you understand that, and that's why I think it's so important, especially youth of today, really know the civil rights movement, the freedom movement, what people, what youth, what families went through, the philosophies of Bruce Hartford's website says there's the philosophical nonviolence, and then there's the tactical nonviolence civil rights activism. And so people have to understand that. But I think for me, it was something that I understood, that, you know, those, a lot of people who have that, you know, they should be prayed for as opposed to, you know, just looked at in a negative light. So
the one of the things that always amazes me is that people who have racist behavior, you know, who are essentially racist, their thoughts, their practices, their behavior, if you call them racist, they're horribly offended. And it's the strangest thing in my mind that somebody could have those opinions and behave in that way, but yet somehow be offended by being, called, what they are, which is racist. And why do you think that is?
I don't know. I always tell the story. When I was young, I was in a school, an elementary play, and it was about the founding fathers in the 13 colonies, and I played John Hancock. And no one had ever told me that at that time in the Constitution that blacks and Indians were considered 3/5 of a human being. And so there was this unsaid you know, notion in the room that, you know, even to this day, a lot of people are just really talking about how, you know, our founding fathers wrote the Constitution, but, you know, half of them owned slaves. And so it's, you know, so you question, you know, how can people do that? And it's like sometimes we just overlook or just bypass and don't deal with reality. And so I think that has a lot to do with it personally.
You're listening to listener-supported community public radio. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. My guest is Kevin Easterling. We're talking about race. We're talking about injustice. We're talking about Martin Luther King Jr. We're talking about the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Project. Kevin, the institutional racism that you talked about, you know, we demonstrated that realtors were steering whites out of Allentown earlier this year, which would be basically stealing equity from anybody who lives in Allentown, because you're removing demand from the marketplace, which depresses prices and depresses prices. It reduces the value of the property, and reducing the value of the property means you don't have equity. And so people of color don't just have a huge income disparity between their white counterparts and themselves, but the wealth disparity is actually far worse, and you don't hear people talking about the wealth disparity. How do you see institutional racism playing itself out in the Lehigh Valley?
How do I see it playing itself out?
Well, you mentioned the concept of institutional racism, and so where do you see that?
Well, I'll give an example. When I talk, I'm not sure how I could really elaborate on the Lehigh Valley, but you look at this past election and some of the tactics that were used, they were actually throwback tactics for voter rights. And so there are certain things that you find some groups will use institutionally to really keep another group down or prohibit them from affording themselves. But I think, and from the aspect of the Lehigh Valley, I think I always tell people 10 years ago, well, 2002, it was splashed across the newspaper that African Americans had the highest per capita income in Allentown at the time. But one thing that lacked, I mean, if you looked at the number of teachers of color who were employed in the school district, the number who worked for, you know, Lehigh County, Northampton County, and different municipalities and cities, and so that equality is still, and sometimes it's not based on institutionalized racism, but just having that opportunity to be a part of, you know, the equity, you know, that we have in the Lehigh Valley, and so I think that's important.
What's up with kids these days? You're close in age to me. I know your mother, your family has been involved for decades. When I watched that documentary about the Freedom Rides, I couldn't help but, you know, feel so disappointed that today's young people have no idea how people act, you know, what people had to do and what courage they had to demonstrate in order to gain any semblance of fairness and equity in our system. What's up with young people today? Why is there not the kind of activism and involvement in any kind of movement that has occurred in prior generations?
Well, I don't know the full answer to that. That's a big question. But I think one of the things is just the fact that a lot of youth today aren't exposed to history. You know, the old saying about, you know, if you don't know your past, you don't know your future or where you're going or something to that notion. But I think just being engaged, we live in a instant gratification society nowadays. Everything's very
but
instant.
But you can't get gratified if you can't get a job, if you don't have equal access to loans, if you don't have, you know, I mean, you're not going to get the, you don't have any mechanism to have instant gratification. I mean, they got to figure that part out, no?
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think the generations before our children, it's important for us to pass on legacies. And that's why one of the things with the King Memorial, that's what we're trying to do. We're saying that, hey, civil rights is important. It helps you understand the past and why the future, why we are where we are now, and what are some of the solutions to move forward. I was doing some research on the civil rights Movement's website, and you know, even when I was young, you know, I'm 47 years old, and you know, Dr. King, I was born, you know, after, you know, he was assassinated and all that, but you know, the watered down version of civil rights that they give you, it doesn't really help you until you really delve into it and understand and say, oh, so this is why things are the way it is. But we have to spark that curiosity in our youth, and help them see how you get further with education and being engaged and just participating in society in itself.
One of the things that I've watched over the years is progressive corporations in the Lehigh Valley who try to diversify their workforces will bring professional blacks into the Lehigh Valley in, you know, management level positions, and they inevitably move on. They don't mm-hmm. stick around. And I, you know, you and I could name many people, I think, mm-hmm. over the years who have come here enticed by great job opportunities from progressive companies and moved on. What's up with that?
Well, you know, you bring me to some of my institutional memory of the Lehigh Valley. There was a gentleman by the name of Thomas Martin, who at the yep. time was the, I think it was the human relations director for the Morning Call. That's when the Morning Call had a human relations director. And he created an organization called Obsidian that dealt with that very issue. You know, you had a lot of young professionals moving to the area, African American in nature, and really, a lot of them, they had the extra money to hang out or to spend. But really, at that time, culturally, you know, a lot of the, it was more advantageous for them to move to somewhere else. Like back then, whether it was Atlanta or South Carolina. I myself, at the time, we had an investment club with a lot of your more progressive professional African Americans. But our turnover was tremendous. You know, every 6 months, someone was leaving and another one was coming in. But and I think of a lot of it just had to do with the Valley at that time, where there wasn't much for them to do from a social perspective.
Kevin, we have just a few seconds. Are you hopeful?
Oh, yes. I'm very hopeful. I think the Lehigh Valley is growing. There's a lot of new folks who are here in the Valley and coming in, and looks like there's going to be some economic prosperity. And if the communities of color, the large populations of Latino and African Americans and other groups can be engaged in and a part of that, I'm very hopeful.
Kevin, I'm with you. We've run out of time. Thanks for joining us tonight. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, listener-supported community public radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.